melted in your mouth. Restaurants served that at Vedienka on holidays, but it had never been so delicious. The people sitting there were solid, respectable types with good and tasteful clothes. Apparently they were important merchants, carefully cutting pieces of fried crackling which oozed with hot fat. They hurriedly placed small pieces of it in their mouths. Meanwhile, they sedately conversed with each other, discussing their business, and sometimes threw a politely curious glance over at Artyom. It was expensive, of course. He had to give over a whole 15 cartridges from his supply and put them in the wide palm of the fat innkeeper, and then he regretted that he'd succumbed to temptation. But his stomach was nonetheless happy, calm, and warm, so the voice of reason was silenced. And the mug of fermented mixture was sweet, and it pleasantly swirled his head, but it wasn't strong. It wasn't that poisonous, turbid home brew in the dirty bottles and jars that would make you weak at the knees with one sniff. Yes, it was only for 3 more cartridges. And what's 3 cartridges if you exchange them for a phial of a sparkling elixir, which helps you to come to terms with the imperfection of this world and restores a certain harmony? Drinking the fermented mixture in small gulps, sitting alone in silence and peace for the first time in a few days, Artyom tried to resurrect recent events in his memory and to understand where he had got to and where he had yet to go. There was still another section of his designated journey to overcome, and he was again at a crossroads. He felt like the hero of the almost forgotten fairy tales of his childhood. The memory of them was so distant now that he didn't remember who had told them to him. Was it Sukhoi, or was it Jenya's parents, or was it his own mother? More than anything, Artyom liked to think that he'd heard them from his mother, and her face even would swim out of the fog for a moment, and he could hear her voice reading to him with smooth intonation. Once upon a time. And so, like the fairy tale hero, he was standing there, and in front of him there were 3 roads, one to Kuznetsky Most, one to Tretyakovskaya, and one to Taganskaya. He savored the intoxicating drink, his body seized by a blissful languor. He didn't want to think at all, and all that was circulating in his head was, go straight, you'll lose your life. Go left, you'll lose your horse. This probably could have gone on forever. He really needed this rest after his recent experiences. It was worth waiting at Kitai Gorod, to look around, to ask the locals about the tunnels. He had to meet up with Khan again to find out if he would be going further with him or if their paths would diverge at this strange station. It hadn't gone at all according to the lazy plan that Artyom had made. He exhaustedly contemplated the small tongue of flame that was dancing in the lamp on the table. Chapter 8, The Fourth Reich. Pistol shots began to crack, slashing through the merry din of the crowd, and then there was a shrill female scream and a machine gun rattled. The chubby innkeeper snatched a small gun from under the counter and ran to the entrance of the tent. Leaving his drink, Artyom leapt up after him, throwing his rucksack on his shoulder, thumbing the safety catch on his gun, regretting as he went that they had made him pay in advance, otherwise he could have slipped away without settling his bill. The 18 cartridges he had spent could prove very useful one day soon. At the top, from the stairs, he could see that something terrible was happening. To get down there, he had to push through the crowd of people who had lost their senses out of fear and who were throwing themselves up the stairs. Soon the crush was so bad that Artyom asked himself whether he really needed to get down there, but his curiosity pushed him forward. On the pathways lay several prostrate bodies, clad in leather jackets, and on the platform right under his feet in a puddle of bright red blood lay a dead woman, face down. He quickly stepped over her, trying not to look down, but he slipped and almost fell. Panic reigned, and half-dressed people were jumping out of their tents, hysterically looking around. One of them was left behind, his foot still stuck in one leg of his trousers, when he suddenly bent over, clutched his stomach and tipped over to the side. But Artyom couldn't figure out where the shooting was coming from. The firing continued, and heavy-set people in leather were running from the other side of the hall, throwing squealing women and frightened traders out of the way. But these weren't the ones being attacked. It was the bandits themselves, the ones who controlled this side of Kitai-Gorod, and along the whole platform it wasn't clear who was creating this slaughterhouse. And then Artyom understood why he didn't see anyone. The attackers were in the tunnel, and they were opening fire from there, apparently afraid of showing themselves in open space. This changed things. There was no more time to reflect. They would come out onto the platform when they felt that there was no more resistance. He had to get away from that entrance as soon as possible. Artyom ran forward, tightly gripping his machine gun and looking over his shoulder. The echo of the thundering shots resounding through the arches made it difficult to tell from which tunnel the shots were coming, the right or the left. Finally, he noticed camouflaged figures in the opening of the left side tunnel. Instead of faces, there was blackness, and Artyom felt a chill inside. Only after a few moments did he remember that the Dark Ones who had encroached on Verdienka never carried weapons and weren't dressed in clothes. The attackers were just wearing masks, balaclavas of the kind you could buy at any arms market. They would even give you one for free when you bought an AK-47. The Kaluga reinforcements had also arrived, and were on the ground, hiding behind the corpses returning fire. You could see how they smashed the plywood boards mounted on the wagon windows, breaking open hidden machine gun positions. Heavy fire thundered. Looking up, Artyom managed to get a glimpse of the plastic tablet that showed the stations, and hung in the middle of the hall. They were attacking from the direction of Tretyakovskaya, so this route was cut off. To get to the Kanskaya, he'd have to go to a part of the station that was now on fire. The only route left to him was to Kuznetsky Most. Jumping onto the path, Artyom headed for the blackened entrance to the one tunnel he could get into. He couldn't see Kaan or Ace anywhere. He thought he saw a figure who reminded him of the wandering philosopher, but when he stopped for a moment, Artyom realized he was mistaken. He wasn't the only one running into the tunnel. Almost half of those escaping were heading that way as well. The passage was ringing with frightened cries. One person was sobbing hysterically. The lights of torches shined here and there, and there was even the uneven flickering of a few fire torches. Each person was lighting the path for himself. Artyom took Khan's present out of his pocket and pressed on the handle. After directing the weak light of the torch to the path under his feet, trying not to trip, he rushed forward, catching up to small groups of fugitives, sometimes whole families, sometimes lone women, old men, and young healthy men, who were dragging parcels that probably didn't belong to them. He stopped a couple of times to help someone who'd fallen. He lingered with one of them for a moment. Leaning against the ribbed wall of the tunnel sat an old man, totally grey, with a painful grimace on his face, clutching his heart. Next to him stood an adolescent boy who was looking serenely and dully. From his animal looks and his turbid eyes you could see that this was an unusual child. Something squeezed Artyom's soul, and when he saw this strange pair, even though he was pressing himself forward and cursing himself when he met obstacles, he stopped. The old man, feeling the attention that was being focused on him and the boy, tried to smile at Artyom and to say something. But he didn't have the breath for it. He frowned and closed his eyes, gathering his strength, and Artyom bent over the old man, trying to hear what he was trying to tell him. But the boy suddenly started to bellow threateningly, and Artyom noticed that there was a thread of spit coming from his mouth, and that he was baring his small yellow teeth. Artyom pushed him aside, and the boy moved back and settled clumsily onto the rails, issuing plaintive howls.
"Young man!"
The old man struggled.
"Don't! He touch Vanichka! He doesn't understand!"
Artyom just shrugged.
"Please! Nitroglycerin in the bag at the bottom. One pill. Give it to me. I can't myself."
The old man wheezed horribly, and Artyom dug into the bag, quickly finding a new-looking package, and he cut through the foil with a fingernail. The pill jumped out and he gave it to the old man, who extended his lips into a guilty smile and said,
"I can't. My hands don't listen to me. Under my tongue."
Then his eyelids closed again. Artyom looked at his black hands in doubt, but he obeyed and put the slippery little ball in the old man's mouth. The stranger nodded weakly and said nothing. More and more fugitives were striding past them hurriedly, but Artyom could only see an endless row of dirty boots and shoes. Sometimes they stumbled on the black wood of the cross ties, and then there was an outburst of swearing. No one paid any attention to the three of them. The teenager was sitting in the same place and was quietly mumbling. Artyom noticed with some indifference and even a little smugness that one of the passers-by kicked him hard, and the boys started to howl even more loudly, smearing his tears with his fists and swaying from side to side. Meanwhile, the old man opened his eyes, sighed heavily, and muttered,
"Thank you very much. I feel better already. Will you help me to get up?"
Artyom supported him by the arm while the man rose with effort, and he picked up the old man's bag, which meant he had to put his machine gun over the other shoulder. The old man began to hobble forward and went to the boy and started encouraging him to get up. The boy bellowed, offended, but when he saw Artyom come up to them, he started to hiss maliciously, and spittle again dripped from his protruding lower lip.
"You see, I just bought the medicine,"
the old man said.
"Indeed, I came here especially for it. To this faraway place, you know. You can't get it where we live. No one brings it in, and there's no one to ask for it. And I had just finished my supply. I took the last tablet on the way here, and when they didn't want to let us through, Pushkinskaya, they're fascists there now, you know. It's just a disgrace to think that at Pushkinskaya they're fascists. I heard that they even want to rename it either to Hitlerskaya or to Schillerovskaya, though of course they haven't even heard of Schiller. And imagine, they didn't want to let us through. Those swaggering fellows with their swastikas started to tease Vanechka. And what could he answer the poor boy in his condition? I was very worried. My heart went bad, and only then did they let us out. What was I saying? Oh, yes, and you see, I especially put them deep into my bag in case anyone searched us, and they would have asked questions. And you know that they could get the wrong idea. Not everyone knows what kind of medicine this is. And suddenly there's all this firing. I ran off as fast as I could. I even had to drag Vanechka because he had seen some chickens on sticks and he really didn't want to go. And to start off with, you know, it wasn't squeezing so hard. I thought maybe it will go away and I don't have to get out the medicine. It's of course worth its weight in gold, but then I understood that I wouldn't manage. And as I reached for a tablet, it got me. And Vanechka, he doesn't understand a thing. I've been trying to teach him for a long time to give me tablets if I don't feel well. But he just can't understand it. And he either eats them himself or he gets the wrong thing out of the bag and gives it to me. I tell him, thank you, smile, and he smiles at me, you know, with such joy. He bellows merrily. God forbid something happens to me. There's no one to take care of him at all, and I can't imagine what would become of him.
The old man talked and talked, ingratiatingly looking into Artyom's eyes, and Artyom felt awkward for some reason. Even though the old man was hobbling with all his strength, Artyom thought that they were moving too slowly. Everyone was overtaking them. It looked like they would soon be last. Vanechka clumsily walked to the right of the old man, holding his hand. His former serene expression had returned to his face. From time to time he pushed his right hand forward and excitedly gurgled, pointing at some object that had been thrown away or dropped as the fugitives ran from the station, sometimes pointing at the darkness that was thickening in front of them.
"Forgive me, young man, but what's your name? Because we're talking, right, and we haven't even introduced ourselves."
"Artyom."
"Artyom, nice to meet you, and I'm Mikhail Porfirovich. Porfirovich, that's right. They called my father Porfiry, an uncommon, you know. And in the Soviet times, he was even questioned by various organizations because at that time there were other names in fashion. Vladilen or Stalin. And you're from where?"
"Verienka."
"Verienka? Well, me and Vanechka, we're from Barikadnaya. I once lived there."
The old man smiled, embarrassed.
"You know, there was a building there. It was such a building, so high, right near the metro. but you probably don't remember any buildings, do you? How old are you, if you don't mind? Well, of course, that's not important. I had a little flat there, two rooms on a high floor, and there was such a wonderful view of the city center. The flat wasn't big, but it was very, you know, comfortable. The floors were, of course, oak, and like all flats, then there was a gas stove. Oh, Lord, I'm thinking right now about just how comfortable a gas stove. And back then, no one cared for them. They all wanted electricity, but they just couldn't get it. As you walked in, there was a reproduction of a Tintoretto painting in a pretty gold-plated frame. What beauty! The bed was real, with pillows, with sheets that were always clean, and a big desk with a lamp, and it burned brightly. But most importantly, there were bookshelves to the ceiling. My father left me a big library, and I collected them, too. Ach, why am I telling you all of this? You probably aren't interested in all this old man nonsense. And yet, still now, you see, I remember, I really miss the things, particularly the desk and the books, and recently I really miss the bed. You don't know such luxuries here, but we had these wooden beds, handmade, you know, and sometimes we slept right on blankets on the floor. But that's nothing. What's important is what's here.
He pointed to his chest.
What's important is what goes on inside and not outside. The important thing is that what's in the head stays the same, and who gives a fig about the condition, excuse my French. But you know that bed, it's especially...
He didn't shut up for a minute. And Artyom listened the whole time with great interest, even though he couldn't at all imagine what it would be like to live in a tall building, and what the view would be like, and what it would be like to go up in a lift. When Mikhail Porfirevich paused for a little while in order to catch his breath, Artyom decided to use the break to turn the conversation in a useful direction. Somehow he had to get through Pushkinskaya and to make the transfer to Chekhovskaya, and from there get to Polis.
Are there really fascists at Pushkinskaya?
He asked.
What's that you're saying? Fascists? Yes.
The old man sighed confusedly.
Yes, yes. You know, the skinheads with the armbands, they're just awful. These symbols are hanging at the entrance there and all over the station. You know, they used to mean that you couldn't go there. It's a black figure in a red circle with a red diagonal line through it. I thought that they had made some kind of mistake, and I asked why they were there. It means that the Dark Ones can't enter. It's some kind of idiocy, basically.
Artyom turned to him when he heard the words Dark Ones. He threw a frightened look at Mikhail Porfirovich and asked carefully,
Are there Dark Ones there now, too? Don't tell me they've reached there, too.
A carousel of panic turned feverishly in Artyom's head. How could it be? He'd only been in the tunnel a week, and the Dark Ones were already attacking Pushkinskaya. Had his mission already failed? He hadn't succeeded, hadn't come good. It was all for nothing. No, that couldn't be. There would have been rumors. They would have distorted things, but there still would have been rumors, right? But it might be the end to everything. Mikhail Porfirevich cautiously looked at him and, stepping a little to the side, carefully asked,
And you... Yourself, what ideology do you adhere to?
I? Basically, well, none. Artyom hesitated. And?
And how do you feel about other nationalities, about Caucasians, for example?
What do Caucasians have to do with anything?
Artyom was puzzled.
Generally, I don't know much about nationalities. There used to be the French there, or the Germans, the Americans, but I guess none of them are left. And as for the Caucasians, if I'm honest, I don't really know any.
He admitted awkwardly.
It's the Caucasians that they call the Dark Ones,
Mikhail Porfirevich explained, still trying to figure out if Artyom was lying, playing the fool.
But Caucasians, if I remember right, are regular people,
Artyom said.
I saw a few of them here today.
Completely normal people,
Mikhail Porfirevich assured him.
Completely normal people. But those cutthroats have decided that there's something different about them and they persecute them. It's simply inhuman, can you imagine? They have a ceiling there, right over the pathways, fitted with hooks, and there was a man hanging from one of them, a real man. Vanechka got so excited that he started to poke it with his finger, to bellow, and then these monsters turned their attention to him.
At the sound of his name, the teenager turned and fixed the old man with a long stare. Artyom had the impression that the boy could hear and could even partly understand what the conversation was about, but when his name wasn't repeated, he quickly lost interest in Mikhail Porfirovich and turned his attention to the cross ties.
And once we started talking about nations, and by the looks of it, they really worship Germans. It was the Germans, after all, who invented their ideology, and you, of course, know what I'm going to tell you.
Mikhail Porfirovich added quickly, and Artyom vaguely nodded, even though he didn't actually know, but he didn't want to look like an ignoramus.
You know, there is a German eagles hanging everywhere, swastikas which are self-explanatory, and there are various German phrases, quotes from Hitler about valor, about pride, and things in that vein. They have parades and marches. While we were there, and I was trying to persuade them to stop antagonizing Vanechka, they were all marching across the platform and singing songs. Something about the greatness of the spirit and contempt for death. But generally, you know, the German language was perfectly chosen. German was simply created for such things. I can speak a little of it, you see. Here, look, I have something written somewhere here.
And breaking step, he extracted a dirty notebook from his inside pocket.
Wait a second. Put your light here, if you don't mind. Where was it? Here it is.
In the yellow circle of light, Artyom saw some jumping Latin letters, carefully drawn on a page of the notebook, and even thoughtfully surrounded with a frame of drawn vine leaves. Du stirbst, besitzt stirbt, die Sippen sterben, der einzig lebt, wir wissen es, der Toten Tatenrum. Artyom could also read Latin letters. He'd studied them in some textbook for school children that they dug up at the station library. He looked behind him and he pointed his torch at the notebook again. Of course he couldn't understand a thing.
What is it?
He asked, again helping Mikhail Porfirovich along and quickly pushing the notebook into the man's pocket and trying to get Vanechka, who was rooted to the spot and growling unhappily, to move forward.
It's a poem,
the old man replied, and he seemed a bit offended.
It's in memory of those that perished in war. I, of course, am not planning to translate, but broadly speaking it means this. You will die. All those close to you will die. Your belongings will disappear, but one thing will cross the centuries. Glorious death in combat. But it comes out so pathetically in Russian, doesn't it? While it just thunders in German, Der Toten Tatenruhm. It just sends a chill through you, yes?
He stopped short, apparently ashamed by his outburst. They walked on quietly for a time. It seemed silly to Artyom, and it angered him too that they were probably the last ones walking the tunnel, and it wasn't clear what was going on behind their backs. And now the guy was stopping to read poetry. But against his will, he was still rolling the last lines of the poem around on his tongue. And for some reason, he suddenly recalled Vitalik, with whom he went to the botanical gardens. Vitalik the splinter, who the robbers had shot down as they tried to break into the station through the southern tunnel. That tunnel was always considered to be dangerous, and therefore they put Vitalik there. He was 18 years old, and Artyom was just coming up to his 16th year. But that evening they agreed to go to Zhenya's because there was a weed trader who had brought in some new stuff, some special stuff. And he got it right in the head. The little black hole was right in the middle of his forehead, and the back of his head was blown off. That was it. You will die. For some reason, the conversation between his stepfather and Hunter came vividly to mind, particularly when Sukhoi said, "And what if there's suddenly nothing there?" You die, and there's nothing beyond that. Nothing. Nothing remains. Someone might remember you for a little while after, but not for long. People close to you will die too. Or how did it go? Artyom really felt a chill now. When Mikhail Porfirovich finally broke the silence, Artyom was actually glad of it.
Will you, by any chance, be going the same way as us, or are you only going to Pushkinskaya? Do you intend to get out there, I mean, get off the path? I would really, really not recommend that you do that, Artyom. You can't imagine what goes on there. Maybe you'd like to go with us to Barakarnaya. I would be most happy to talk to you along the way.
Artyom again nodded indistinctly and mumbled something non-committal. He couldn't just discuss the aims of his journey with the first person he met, even if that person was an inoffensive old man. Mikhail Porfirovich went silent, having heard nothing in answer to what he'd asked. They walked for quite a long time more in silence. Everything sounded quiet behind them, too, and Artyom finally relaxed. In the distance, lights were shining, at first weakly, but then brighter and brighter. They were approaching Kuznetsky Most. Artyom knew nothing about the local order of things, and so he decided to hide his weapon. After wrapping it up in his vest, he pushed it deep into his rucksack. Kuznetsky Most was an inhabited station, and about 50 meters before the entrance, in the middle of the path, there stood a sturdy checkpoint. It was only one checkpoint, but it had a searchlight, though it was turned off at the moment since it wasn't needed, and it was equipped with a machine gun position. The machine gun was covered, but next to it sat a very fat man in a threadbare green uniform. He was eating some kind of mash from a beaten-up soldier's bowl. There were yet another couple of people in the same outfit with clumsy-looking army machine guns on their shoulders who nitpickingly checked the documents of those who were coming out of the tunnel. There was a small line in front of them, all the fugitives who had come from Kitaigorod, who had overtaken Artyom while he had walked slowly with Mikhail Porfirovich and Venechka. The people were slowly and reluctantly admitted. One guy had been rejected, and he was now sitting in dismay, not knowing what to do, and trying from time to time to approach the checkpoint guards, who pushed him off each time, and called up the next person in line. Each of the arriving people was thoroughly searched, and they saw for themselves how a man on whom they'd found an undeclared Makarov pistol was thrown out of the line, and when he tried to argue with them, they tied him up and led him away. Artyom felt a twirling inside, sensing that trouble was ahead. Mikhail Porfirovich was looking at him in surprise, and Artyom quietly whispered that he was armed. But the man just nodded reassuringly and promised him that everything would be all right. It wasn't that Artyom trusted him, but thought that it would be very interesting to see how he intended to settle the matter. The old man merely smiled mysteriously. Slowly their turn approached. The border guards were now gutting the insides of some 50-year-old woman's coat, while she took to accusing them of being tyrants and expressing surprise that people such as them could exist. Artyom agreed with her, but he decided not to voice his solidarity audibly. Digging around, the guard, with a satisfied whistle, took several grenades from her dirty brassiere and looked for an explanation. Artyom was sure that the woman would now tell a touching story about her grandson who needed these things for his work. You see, he works as a welder, and this is part of his welding equipment. Or she'd say that she had found these grenades along the road, and she was, as it happens, rushing to give them to the relevant authorities. But taking a couple of steps backwards, she hissed a curse and rushed back into the tunnel, hurrying to hide in the darkness. The machine gunner set aside his bowl of food and gripped his unit. But one of the two border guards, apparently the older one, stopped him with a gesture. The fat one sighed in disappointment and turned back to his porridge, and Mikhail Porfirovich took a step forward, holding his passport at the ready. It was amazing, but the senior guard, without the slightest twinge of conscience, having upturned the whole bag belonging to the completely inoffensive-looking woman, quickly leafed through the old man's notebook and didn't pay a jot of attention to Vanechka, as though he wasn't there. It was Artyom's turn. He readily gave his documents over to the lean moustached guard, and the man started meticulously scrutinizing each page of them, and shined his torch on his stamps for an especially long time. The border guard compared Artyom's physiognomy no less than 5 times against the photograph, outwardly expressing his doubts, while Artyom gave a friendly smile, trying to portray himself as innocence itself.
"Where's your passport, the Soviet model?"
the guard finally asked with a stern voice, not knowing what else to pick on.
"I was little, see, when there were still real ones, and then our administration corrected the situation with the first form they could find to fill in."
"That's out of order." The man frowned. "Open your rucksack."
If he detects the machine gun, Artyom thought, then he could run back. Otherwise, they would confiscate it. He wiped perspiration from his forehead. Mikhail Porfirovich went up to the guard and stood very close to him and whispered quickly,
"Konstantin Alexeyevich, you understand this young man is my friend. He's a very, very decent youth. I can guarantee it personally."
The border guard opened Artyom's bag and pushed his hand inside it. Artyom went cold. Then the guard said dryly,
"5.
And while Artyom figured out what he meant, the old man pulled a fistful of cartridges out of his pocket, and quickly counting out 5, he put them into the half-open field bag that was hanging off the guard's belt. But Konstantin Alexeyevich's hand had continued its rummaging in Artyom's bag, and apparently the worst had happened because his face took on a suddenly interested expression. Artyom felt his heart falling into a precipice, and he shut his eyes.
15,
the guard said impassively. After nodding, Artyom counted off 10 additional cartridges and poured them into the same bag. Not one muscle flickered on the face of the border guard. He simply took a step to the side, and the path to Kuznetsky Most was free and clear. With admiration for the man's iron restraint, Artyom went forward. The next 15 minutes was spent squabbling with Mikhail Porfirovich, who stubbornly refused to accept 5 cartridges from Artyom, assuring him that his debt to Artyom was much greater. Kuznetsky Most was no different from most of the other stations that Artyom had managed to see on his journey so far. It had the same marble on the walls and granite on the floors, but the arches here were unusually high and wide, creating an unusual sensation of spaciousness. But the most surprising thing was that on each of the tracks stood entire trains that were incredibly long and so enormous that they took up almost all the room at the station. The windows were lit up with a warm light that shone through variously colored curtains, and the doors were welcomingly open. Artyom had not seen anything like it. Yes, he had half-erased memories of swiftly moving and hooting trains with bright squares of windows. The memories were from his early childhood, but they were diffuse, ephemeral, like the other thoughts about what had gone before. As soon as he tried to remember any details, to focus on something small, then the elusive image dissolved right away and flowed like water through his fingers, and there was nothing left. But since he'd grown up, he had only seen the train that had got stuck in the tunnel entrance at Drishkaya and some wagons at Kitaygor or Dan Prospekt Mir. Artyom froze on the spot, captivated, looking at the train, counting the carriages that melted into the haze of the other end of the platform near the entrance to the Red Line. There, a red calico banner hung down from the ceiling, snatched from the darkness by a distinct circle of electric light, and underneath it stood 2 machine gunners in identical green uniforms and peak caps, who seemed small from far away and amusingly reminiscent of toy soldiers. Artyom had 3 toy soldiers like them when he lived with his mother. One was the commander with a tiny pistol pulled out of its holster. He was yelling something, looking backwards. He was probably ordering his group to follow him into battle. The other 2 stood straight, holding their machine guns. The little soldiers were probably from different collections, and there was no way to play with them. The commander was throwing himself into battle, and despite his valiant cries, the other 2 were standing in place, just like the border guards of the Red Line, and they weren't particularly heading for battle. It was strange, he remembered these soldiers so well, and yet he couldn't remember his mother's face. Kuznetsky Most was relatively orderly. The light here, like at Vedienko, came from emergency lights that were strung along the length of the ceiling on some kind of mysterious metal construction that had perhaps once illuminated the station itself. Apart from the trains, there was absolutely nothing remarkable about the station.
"I've heard so often that there are so many amazingly beautiful places in the metro, but from what I can see, they're almost all identical."
Artyom shared his disappointment with Mikhail Porfirovich.
"Come now, young man. There are such beautiful places you wouldn't believe. There's Komsomolskaya on the Ring, a veritable palace."
The old man heatedly took to persuading him.
"There's an enormous panel there, you know, on the ceiling. It has Lenin on it and other rubbish is true. Oh, what am I saying?"
He stopped short and with a whisper said to Artyom,
"This station is full of secret agents from the Sokolnicheskaya line. That's to say the Red Line. Sorry, I call things by their old names. So you have to be quiet here. The local leadership looks like it's independent, but they don't want to quarrel with the Reds. So if they ask them to hand someone over, then they can just hand you over, not to mention the murders.
He added very quietly, looking timidly from side to side.
Come on, let's find somewhere to rest. To be honest, I'm terribly tired, and indeed you, in my opinion, are only barely managing to stay on your feet. Let's spend the night here, and then we'll go on.
Artyom nodded. This day had indeed seemed to be endless and stressful, and rest was absolutely necessary. Enviously sighing and not taking his eyes off the train, Artyom followed Mikhail Porfirovich. There was joyful laughter and conversation coming from the carriages, and they passed a man standing in the doorway. He looked tired after a day's work and was smoking a cigarette with his neighbor, calmly discussing the events of the day. Gathered around a table, old ladies were drinking tea under a small lamp that was hanging from a wire, and children were running wild. This seemed unusual to Artyom. At Vedienka the conditions were always very tense, and people were ready for anything to happen. Yes, people got together in the evenings to sit quietly with friends in someone's tent, but there was nothing like this where doors were open in full view and people were visiting each other so easily, children everywhere. This station was just too happy. And what do they live on here? Artyom couldn't contain himself as he caught up to the old man.
What? You don't know?
Mikhail Porfirovich said politely, but he was surprised.
This is Kuznetsky Most. You get the best technicians in the metro here, important masters. They bring all sorts of devices to be fixed here from the Sokolnicheskaya line, even from the ring itself. They're flourishing, flourishing. What it would be like to live here, huh?
He sighed dreamily.
But they're very strict about that.
Artyom hoped in vain that they would also be able to sleep in one of the railroad cars on a bed. In the middle of the hall stood a row of big tents, the kind that they lived in at Vidyenka, and the first one they came to had a stenciled inscription on it that said, Hotel. Next to it was a whole line of fugitives, but Mikhail Porfirovich, calling one of the organizers to the side, tinkled some copper and whispered something magical, starting with Konstantin Alexeyevich, and the matter was settled.
We'll go here,
he said with an inviting gesture, and Vanechka joyfully gurgled. They even gave them some tea there, and he didn't have to pay anything extra for it, and the mattresses on the floor were so soft that after you'd fallen on them, you really didn't want to have to get up. Half reclining, Artyom carefully blew on the mug of tea and attentively listened to the old man, who was telling him something with a burning look, having forgotten about his cup of tea.
They have power across the whole branch, and no one will tell you about that, and the Reds will never admit to it. But university is not under their control, and everything beyond university, too. Yes, yes, the Red Line continues to Sportivnaya. There's a passage that starts there, you know, which was once the station Leninskie Gori. And then they changed the name, but I can only remember the old one. But Leninskie Gori was below a bridge, actually. And you see, there was an explosion on the bridge, and it collapsed into the river, and the station was flooded. So there hasn't been any communication with university from the very beginning.
Artyom swallowed a little gulp of tea, and felt that everything inside was sweetly freezing in place in anticipation of something mysterious, unusual, that something had started back where the broken rails hovered over a precipice on the Red Line down in the southwest. Vanechka was gnawing on his nails, only stopping sometimes to look with satisfaction at the fruits of his labor, and then starting up again. Artyom looked at him almost with sympathy, and felt grateful to the boy that he was being quiet.
You know, we have a small circle at the Barikadnaya,
Mikhail Porfirovich smiled embarrassedly.
And we get together in the evenings. Sometimes people come to us from Ulitsa 1905, and now they chased all the differently thinking people, and Anton Petrovich moved to our station, too. It's nonsense, of course. These are simple literary gatherings, but we sometimes talk about politics. They don't especially like educated people at Barikadnaya, either. So we just do it on the quiet. But Yakov Yosifovich was saying that allegedly University Station didn't perish, that they managed to block off the tunnel and there's still people there now. Not just people, but... you understand, that's where Moscow University used to be. That's where the station is called University. And so allegedly some of their professoriate were saved at University Station and some students too. There was some kind of bomb shelter under the university, something constructed by Stalin, and I think they were connected by special tunnels to the metro, and now there's another kind of intellectual center there, you know, but that's probably just legend, that there's educated people in power there, and all the three stations and the shelter are governed by a rector, and each station is headed by a deacon, all elected for a specified term. Their studies aren't at a standstill. There are still students, you know, post-grads, teachers, and culture hasn't died out, not like it has here. And they write things, and they haven't forgotten how to conduct research. And Anton Petrovich even said that one of his friends, an engineer, told him in secret that they'd even found a way to go to the surface. They created a protective suit, and sometimes their scouts are sent into the metro. You'll agree that it sounds improbable.
Mikhail Porfirovich added half-questioningly, looking Artyom in the eye, and Artyom noticed something sad in his eyes, a timid and tired hope that made Artyom cough a little, and answer as confidently as possible.
Why, it sounds completely possible. Take Polis, for example. I heard the same about it.
Yes, it's a wonderful place, Polis. But how can you get there these days? They told me that at the council the power has been taken by the military.
Which council?
Artyom raised his eyebrows.
What? Polis is governed by a council of the most authoritative people, and there, you know, authoritative people are either librarians or servicemen. But I don't really know about Biblioteca Lenina exactly, so there's no point in talking about it. But the other entrance to Polis is located right behind the Ministry of Defense, as far as I remember, or, in any case, it was somewhere nearby, and some of the generals were able to evacuate to it at the time. At the very beginning, the military men took power and this junta ruled Polis for a sufficiently long time. But the people didn't really like them ruling. There was disorder of the blood-spilling kind. But that was a long time ago, a long time before the war with the Reds. Then they came to a compromise and this council was founded. And it happened that within it there were two factions, the librarians and the servicemen. It was a strange combination, of course. You know, the military had probably not met many live librarians in their lives, and here they were together. And between these factions there was an eternal fight, of course. One would take control, then the other. When the war started with the Reds, defense was more important than culture, and the scales tipped to the generals. Then peaceful times began, and again the librarians gained influence. And it's like a pendulum there. Now I hear that the military people have a stronger position, and they're imposing discipline there, you know, curfews and all those other joys of life.
Mikhail Porfirovich quietly smiled.
Going through there isn't any easier than getting to the Emerald City. That's what we call university among ourselves, and the station surrounding it for a joke. You have to go either through the Red Line or through the Hansa, but you can't just go there as... you yourself understand. Before the fascists, you could go through Pushkinskaya to Tchaikovskaya, and then it's just one transfer to Borovitskaya. It's not a good transfer, of course, but when I was younger, I made my way through it.
Artyom asked what was so bad about the transfer he mentioned, and the old man reluctantly answered,
"You understand, right there in the middle of the tunnel, there's a burnt-out train. I haven't been there in ages, so I don't know how it is now, but before you could see charred human remains sitting in its seats, it was just terrible. I don't know how this happened, and I asked some friends, but no one has been able to say exactly. And it's very hard to get through this train, because the tunnel has started to collapse, and dirt has filled in all the spaces around the train. In the train itself, in the carriages, I mean, various bad things are going on, and it would be difficult to explain them. I'm an atheist in general, you know, and I don't believe in all that mystical nonsense, and now I don't believe in anything anymore."
These words led Artyom to the gloomy memories of the noise in the tunnel on his line, and he couldn't restrain himself. And he told the old man what had happened to his group, and then what happened with Bourbon, and after hesitating a little he tried to repeat the explanation that Khan had given him.
What are you talking about? That's utter rubbish!
Mikhail Porfirovich brushed him off, sternly knitting his brows.
I've already heard about such things. You remember I was telling you about Yakov Yosefovich? Well, he's a physicist, and he explained to me that these disruptions to the psyche occur when people are subjected to the lowest frequencies of sound. They are essentially inaudible. If I'm not mistaken, it's around 7 hertz, but then my mind is like a sieve, and this sound can come about by itself as a result of natural processes, for example, from tectonic shifts and things like that. I wasn't listening very attentively as he told me about it, but that it has something to do with souls of the dead in the pipes, please.
This old man was interesting. Artyom heard things from him that he had never heard from anyone else. The man saw the metro from a different angle, an old-fashioned one, an amusing one, and everything apparently pulled his soul to the surface of the earth. He was clearly very uncomfortable here, as though these were his first days underground, and Artyom, thinking of the argument between Sukhoi and Hunter, asked him,
"And what do you think? We, people, I mean, will we ever return to the surface? Will we survive and go back?"
And he immediately regretted asking it, because it was as though the question had cut into the old man's very veins. And he became soft straight away and said quietly with a lifeless voice,
"I don't think so. I don't think so."
"But after all, there were other metro systems in Petersburg, in Minsk, and in Novgorod."
Artyom listed the names he had learnt by heart. They'd always been empty shells of words.
"Ah, what a beautiful city, Petersburg."
Mikhail Porfirovich didn't answer him, but sadly sighed.
"You know, Isaacs, or Admiral Teistvo, the spire there, what grace, what grace. And evenings on Nevsky Prospekt, people, noise, crowds, laughter, children with ice cream, pretty girls, music playing. In summer especially, it's really good weather in the summer there, but when it happens, the sun, the sky is clear, azure. And then, you know, it's just easy to breathe again."
His eyes fixed on Artyom, but his gaze was going right through the young man and dissolved in the ethereal distance, where translucent, majestic silhouettes of the dusty buildings rose from the dusky smoke, giving Artyom the impression that he could have turned around and seen it for himself. The old man went quiet, heaved a deep sigh, and Artyom decided not to interrupt his reminiscing.
"Yes, there were indeed other metro systems apart from Moscow's. Maybe people took refuge there and saved themselves. But think about it, young man."
Mikhail Porfirovich raised a knotty finger in the air.
"How many years have gone by and nothing? Surely they would have found us after all these years if they had been looking for us." "No,"
he dropped his head,
"I don't think so."
And then after 5 minutes of silence, almost inaudibly, the old man sighed and said, more to himself than to Artyom,
"Lord, what a splendid world we ruined."
A heavy silence hung in the tent. Vanechka, lulled by their quiet conversation, was sleeping, with his mouth slightly open and snuffling quietly, sometimes whining a little like a dog. Mikhail Porfirovich didn't say another word, and though Artyom was sure that he wasn't yet sleeping, he didn't want to disturb him, so he closed his eyes and tried to fall asleep. He was thinking that after everything that had happened to him over the course of that endless day, sleep would come instantly. But time stretched out slowly, slowly. The mattress, which had seemed so soft not long ago, now seemed lumpy, and he had to turn over many times before he could find a comfortable position. The old man's sad words were knocking and knocking around in his ears. "No, I don't think so. There will be no return to the sparkling avenues, the grandiose architectural constructions, the light, refreshing breezes of a warm summer evening running through your hair and caressing your face. No more sky. It will never be like the old man described again." Now the sky was receding upwards, enmeshed in the decayed wires of the tunnel ceiling, and so it would remain forever. But before it was, what did he say? Azure? Clear? The sky was strange, just like the one that Artyom saw at the botanical gardens that time, covered in stars, but instead of being velvet blue, it was light blue, shimmering, joyful. And the buildings were really enormous, but they didn't press down with their mass. No, they were light, easy, as though they were woven out of sweet air. They soared, almost leaving the earth, their contours washed in the endless height of the sky. And how many people there were! Artyom had never seen so many people at once, only perhaps at Kitaigorod. But here there were even more of them. The space in between these great buildings was full of people. They scurried around, and there were a great deal of children among them, and they were eating something, probably real ice cream. Artyom had even wanted to ask one of them if he could try some. He'd never eaten real ice cream. When he was little, he'd really wanted to try some, but there had been nowhere to get any. The confectionery factory had long since produced only mold and rats and mold. But these little children, licking the delicacy, were running away from him and laughing, deftly dodging him, and he didn't even get the chance to look into any of their faces. Artyom didn't know any more what he was trying to do, take a bite of ice cream or just to look one of the children in the face, to understand if the children did actually have faces. And he got scared. The light outlines of the building started to slowly darken, and after some time, they were hanging over him threateningly. And then they started to move closer and closer. Artyom was still chasing the children, and it seemed to him that the children weren't laughing joyfully, but evilly, and then he gathered all his strength and grabbed one of the little boys by the sleeve. The boy pulled away and scratched him like a devil, but squeezing the boy's throat with an iron grip, Artyom managed to look him in the face. It was Vanechka. Roaring and baring his teeth, he shook his head and tried to seize Artyom's hand. In panic, Artyom flung him away, and the boy, jumping up from his knees, suddenly lifted his head and let out that same terrible howl which made Artyom run back at Vedienka. And the children, randomly rushing around, started to slow down and slowly to look at him from the side, getting closer, and the black, bulky buildings towered right over them, drawing closer, and the children were filling the decreasing spaces between the buildings, and they took up Vanechka's struggle, full of savage malice and icy sadness, and finally they turned to Artyom. They didn't have faces, only black leather masks with mouths painted on them, and eyes without whites or pupils. And suddenly there was a voice that Artyom couldn't place. It was quiet, and the vicious battle was drowning it, but the voice repeated itself insistently and, listening closely, trying not to pay attention to the children who were getting closer and closer, Artyom finally figured out what it was saying. "You have to go," and it said it again, and Artyom recognized the voice. It was Hunter's. He opened his eyes and threw off his covers. It was dark in the tent and very muggy. His head was filled with lead weight, his thoughts turned over lazily and heavily. Artyom couldn't seem to come to his senses to figure out how long he'd slept and whether it was time to get up and get on the road or whether he should just turn over and try to have a better dream. Then the tent flaps were pulled aside, and through it poked the head of the border guard who had let them into Kuznetsky Most. Konstantin, what was his second name?
Mikhail Porfirovich! Mikhail Porfirovich, get up now! Mikhail Porfirovich, has he died or what?
And not paying any attention to Artyom, who was staring at him in fright, he climbed into the tent and started to shake the sleeping old man. Vanechka woke up first and started to bellow badly. The guard didn't pay him any attention, and when Vanechka tried to pull on his arm, he boxed him on the ear. And then the old man woke up.
Mikhail Porfirovich, get up quickly,
the border guard whispered urgently.
You have to go. The Reds are asking for you to be handed over as a slanderer and enemy propagandist. I've been telling you and telling you, while you're here, while you're at our lousy station, don't start with your university talk. Did you listen to me?
Please, Konstantin Alexeyevich, what is all of this?
The old man's head turned in confusion, rising from his cot.
I didn't say anything, no propaganda. Perish the thought. I was only telling the young man about it, but very quietly, and there were no witnesses.
We'll take the young man with you. You know what kind of station this is. On Lublyanka, they'll gut you and string you up on a stick, and your friend here will be put against the wall straight away so that he doesn't go talking again. Come on, be quick. Why are you hanging around? They're coming for you right now. They're just conferring for a moment to decide what to ask the Reds for in exchange, so hurry up.
Artyom had stood up, and had his rucksack on his back. He didn't know whether to get out his weapon or not. The old man was also fussing, but a minute later, they were already on the road, walking quickly, whereupon Konstantin Alexeyevich himself pressed a hand over Vanechka's mouth with a martyred expression, and the old man looked over at him anxiously, afraid that the frontier guard might twist the boy's neck. The tunnel leading to Pushkinskaya was better defended than the other had been. Here they passed two cordons, at 100 and at 200 meters from the entrance. At the first one, there were concrete reinforcements, a parapet that cut across the way and forced people along a narrow path by the wall, and to the left of it was a telephone, and its wire led right into the center of the station, probably to the headquarters. At the second cordon, there were the usual sandbags, the machine gun, and the searchlights, like at the other side. There were duty officers at both posts, but Konstantin Alexeyevich led them through both cordons to the border.
Let's go. I'll walk with you for 5 minutes. I'm afraid that you can't come here again, Mikhail Porfirovich,
he said as they walked slowly towards Pushkinskaya.
They haven't yet forgiven you for your old sins, and you've done it again. I heard that Comrade Moskvin is personally interested, you hear? Well, okay, we'll try to think of something. Be careful as you go through Pushkinskaya,
he said as they carried on through the darkness.
Go through it quickly. We're afraid of them, you see. So be off and be well.
Meanwhile, there was nowhere to rush to, so the fugitives shortened their stride.
What made them so bitter about you?
Artyom asked, curiously looking over at the old man.
Well, you see, I just dislike them very much. And when the war was on, well, basically, you see, my little circle put together some texts. And Anton Petrovich, he then lived in Pushkinskaya, had access to a typographical press. There was a press at Pushkinskaya where some madmen were printing news, and that's where he printed it.
But the Reds' border looks harmless. There are two people there, there's a flag hanging. There are no reinforcements, nothing like the Hansa has,
Artyom suddenly remembered.
Of course. From this side everything is harmless because their main force is on the inside, not the outside,
Mikhail Porfirovich smiled maliciously.
That's where the reinforcements are. On the borders it's just decoration.
They went on in silence, each thinking their private thoughts. Artyom was listening to his sensations about the tunnel. It was a strange business, but this tunnel and also the one that led from Kitai-Goro to Kuznetsky Most were both empty, and you didn't feel anything inside them. They weren't filled with anything. They were just soulless constructions. Then he remembered the nightmare he had just had. The details of it had already been wiped from his memory, and all that was left were vague, frightening memories of faceless children and black masses against the sky. But there was the voice. He couldn't follow the thought to its end. In front of him he heard the familiar awful squeaking and the rustle of paws, and then there was the suffocating sweetish smell of rotting flesh. And when the weak light of their torches reached the place where these sounds were coming from, they saw in front of their eyes such a scene that Artyom thought it might perhaps be preferable to return to the Reds. At the wall, face down in a row, lay three swollen bodies, their hands tied behind their backs with wire, and they had already been gnawed at by the rats. Pressing his jacket sleeve to his nose so that he couldn't smell the heavy, sweetish and poisonous air, Artyom bent down over the bodies and shined his light at them. They were stripped to their underwear, and their bodies showed no evidence of injury. But the hair on each of their heads was stuck together with blood, especially thickly around the black dot of the bullet hole.
In the back of the head,
Artyom pointed out, trying to make his voice sound calm and feeling that he might suddenly vomit. Mikhail Porfirovich half opened his mouth and his eyes began to shine.
What they do, my God, what they do,
he said, sighing.
Vanechka, don't look, come here.
But Vanechka, without showing the slightest unease, hunkered down next to the nearest corpse and began to point a finger at it, bellowing animatedly. The torch's beam slipped up the wall, and it lit up a piece of dirty paper, which was stuck right above the corpses at eye level. Above it, the letters Vierter Reich were painted, accompanied by a depiction of an eagle. It went on in Russian, "Not one swarthy animal is allowed within 300 meters of the Great Reich," and the same "No Through Way" sign was also displayed with its circular black outline and little man crossed out.
Swine,
Artyom said through clenched teeth,
because